Support for this podcast comes from Wise, the account that lets you send, spend, and receive money internationally. 50 currencies, 170 countries. One account designed to take on the world. So whether you're taking on Rio or Rome, Miami or Mumbai, you'll always get the mid-market exchange rate when you convert currencies, with no markups and no hidden fees. Wise helps you save money no matter where you're going next. Join 15 million people and businesses who are going global with Wise. Learn how the Wise account could work for you by downloading the app or visiting wise.com/world.
The death of former Italian Prime Minister Silvio Berlusconi, a seriously divisive figure who, like another recently deceased ruler, has prompted a big reaction.
A little bit like when, you know, in the UK, the Queen was dead. It's a similar situation.
Also today, in a disputed region in the Caucasus, school children have to choose. Wait in line for food assistance or go to class and learn.
It's either your survival mode or your education, and it's a hard choice between those two.
And in Beirut, a cultural institution rises again. The massive port explosion nearly 3 years ago shuttered one of Lebanon's oldest museums. The building ruined, paintings damaged. Now the museum is reopened.
It's a safe space today in a city where there has been so much trauma.
I'm Marco Werman. All that and much more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Thank you for starting the week with us. Ukraine has now unfurled its yellow and blue flag over four villages they have recaptured, visible signs that the long-awaited counteroffensive is underway. To be clear, these are the opening chapters in what will undoubtedly be a long and tough slog into Russian-held territory in Ukraine. To understand how the counteroffensive is taking shape, we got in touch with Emily Harding of the Center for Strategic and International Studies. What are the specifics on Ukraine's gains so far, Emily?
Right. Well, as you said at the uptake, the four villages they seem to have taken over is definitely a good sign that the counteroffensive is moving forward. It seems that they are trying to push through in the eastern part of the country, and some of Ukraine's military personnel have indicated they are seeking to cut the land bridge that links the eastern part of Russian forces with the western part of Russian forces. So ideally, they would push through to the Azov Sea and then cut off the forces from Russia that are on Crimea and then in that southern part of Ukraine so that it would be very difficult to reinforce those forces.
Is the goal for Ukraine still to retake Crimea and eastern Ukraine, the Donbas?
Absolutely. Zelensky has not backed down at all from his commitment to take back every inch of Ukrainian territory, including Crimea, including the Donbas. I've been asked a lot lately about whether or not it looks like this counteroffensive could be designed to somehow create excellent opportunities for negotiation. I just don't see it happening. The Ukrainians seem committed to taking back every inch of territory.
What advantages does Russia have at this point?
It's always easier to be the defender. Then they have dug extensive fortifications. They have trenches. They have these things called dragon's teeth that basically look like little concrete pokes sticking up out of the ground that make it very difficult for certain armored vehicles to cross massive amounts of territory. And just being the defender, it's a lot easier to push back an offensive than it is to take new territories.
And what does Ukraine have on its side in terms of advantage?
So it is their territory. They understand it well, and they have the support of the local population. Those are huge advantages in any kind of fight like this. In addition, Western aid is flowing in increasing quantities. We're already seeing the Leopard tanks being deployed on the battlefield. More Abrams are inbound. There's been talk of F-16 showing up maybe soon. And then the West is trying to just keep a solid flow of artillery shells coming into Ukraine. The 155s are really important.
Well, we've heard a lot about the request from Ukraine for that hardware and the delivery of it. So is there anything right now that could make a huge difference, a tactical difference on the battlefield?
Yes. I mean, I do think that aircraft would make a difference. I know the West has been hesitant to provide those because they could be a long strike weapon. Having the capability to hit Russian forces behind those fortifications that we were discussing, that would be a huge bonus for the Ukrainian troops. And then in any kind of push forward like this, I mean, tanks are going to be destroyed on the battlefield. The Russians do know how to do that. We've already seen some unconfirmed footage of a Leopard burning on the battlefield. So keeping that flow of equipment coming will be really important.
You know, one thing that strikes me as kind of odd is all the talk of the counteroffensive before it actually began. What's the reason for that? And does it dilute the element of surprise for Ukraine?
Yeah, I'm not sure there was really an element of surprise to start off with this fight.
Yeah,
the West has been impatient, I think, to see this fight really start to move forward again. Some politicians are starting to get a little bit concerned about their home populations, wondering why we're funneling so much aid into Ukraine if we're not seeing results on the battlefield. To be clear, that's the wrong way to look at it. The Ukrainians know exactly when the right time is to launch an offensive like this and not before, and trying to force them into it quickly is just a terrible idea, both for the actual success on the battlefield and then also for the partnership. So, yeah.
Is there any way to predict how things might progress this summer?
The most logical analysis right now would be that we will see 5 months of really intensive fighting along the line from about Zaporizhia up to Donetsk. But that said, the Ukrainians have also been pretty good at feints and distractions, so it's possible they're going to push forward in one place and then make gains somewhere else. Also, the big wild card is the collapse at the dam at Novokakhovka. That flooding has been extensive and has definitely disrupted Ukrainian capabilities, but then also literally flooded a bunch of Russian positions on the left side of the river. So that, I think, is going to be a big wild card as well.
Emily Harding is a deputy director and senior fellow at the International Security Program, the Center for Strategic and International Studies. Thank you very much, Emily. Good to have you with us today.
Thank you.
For decades, Armenia and Azerbaijan have been engaged in a territorial conflict. They've been fighting over the disputed region of Nagorno-Karabakh. It's populated by ethnic Armenians, but it's internationally recognized as part of Azerbaijan. For nearly 6 months, Azerbaijan has blocked the one road that connects the region to Armenia, effectively cutting people off from the outside world. As Levi Bridges reports from the Armenian capital Yerevan, the blockade has made it much harder for Armenian students to get an education.
On a recent spring day, students are hanging out in the hallways of the Lyceum, a gifted and talented school in Stepanakert, the regional capital of Nagorno-Karabakh. Because it's not possible to visit the region, one of the students' teachers recorded audio of the school for me. Coming to school is something these students no longer take for granted. During the blockade, authorities in Nagorno-Karabakh have accused Azerbaijan of periodically cutting off their gas and electricity supply. Last winter, schools here had to shut down completely because there was no gas to heat them. Ani Haratunyan is an English teacher at the Lyceum.
Generally, the education was stopped. No one went to schools. It's quite difficult to imagine in the 21st century that something like this is possible.
Schools eventually opened up again, but classes were shorter because it was so cold. And students sat bundled up in big coats and scarves because there still wasn't any heat. It affected students' performance.
Before the blockade, they used to have higher marks. They used to be more prepared for the classes.
Schools in Nagorno-Karabakh were back up and running again by this spring once the weather warmed up. But for students, there are still all these distractions. Because of the blockade, there are food shortages. So now, locals wait in line to get food aid from Russian peacekeepers, including 16-year-old Arpi Asmaryan.
Sometimes we spend the entire day in lines, which means that we can't get to our classes. It's either your survival mode or your education, and it's a hard choice between those two.
Outside Stepanakert, in rural areas, students face other complications. Nina Shafardyan teaches in a village on the border with Azerbaijan. This year, their school couldn't take students on field trips into the Caucasus Mountains because soldiers from Azerbaijan sometimes fire shots at local Armenians.
Children, they ask you, like, when we will climb the mountain, but your answer is like, you know, we can't climb this mountain because there is no guarantee that Azerbaijani people will not shoot you there. So it's really hard.
Armenia and Azerbaijan are trying to negotiate a peace deal, but it's still unclear when the blockade will end. Kanar Hachatarian was planning to leave her village in Nagorno-Karabakh and start college in Yerevan next fall.
I feel so sad. You know, I had made a lot of dreams about my future and I have a lot of plans. But if I don't go there in the university, it all won't happen.
There's a reason this current blockade is so heartbreaking for Armenians everywhere.
For Armenians, like, there's nothing more important than education.
Nanor Balabanyan is the founder of the Hidden Road Initiative, a nonprofit that works to expand education and leadership opportunities for Armenians. We met up in Armenia's capital, Yerevan.
It's kind of what keeps the people strong enough to keep going. because the people here know that even if we don't have the weapons and the infrastructure and all the other things the big guys have, we have access to education, and with education, that's another way of fighting.
Armenia's government has signaled they might accept Azerbaijan's control over Nagorno-Karabakh in a potential peace deal. Some people I talk to who live there are outraged and say they'll stay and fight. Schools in the region are currently installing wood stoves so they can stay open next winter during a blockade that has no clear end in sight. For the world, Levi Bridges, Yerevan, Armenia.
The United Nations released a new report today gauging bias against women, and the conclusion, close to 9 out of 10 people, men and women, hold fundamental biases against women, according to the report. Raquel Lagunas is head of gender equality for the United Nations Development Program. Going beyond the numbers, Raquel, we want to know why people hold biases against women still. What is your headline?
There is a combination of factors, right? Starting by the cultural, historical kind of background of societies and countries. So, and we learned, right? We learned what does it mean being a woman? What does it mean being a man? In some societies are by far more traditional. And what we call the patriarchy, that is this kind of, no, of discriminatory practices, are very much at the core of the problem.
So drilling down into the 9 out of 10 people around the world still hold biases against women, some other numbers, nearly half the world's people believe that men make better political leaders than women. 2 out of 5 people believe that men make better business executives than women do. Let me take that second statistic. Help us understand the belief that men make better business executives than women. What's behind that?
Well, behind that is the tradition that men have been exposed to the public sphere, women to the house, to the home, taking care of the kids, men to the public, right? So to lead, to take decisions. So it's a very traditional way of understanding societies.
And that applies also to why there's this belief that men make better politicians, I'm guessing?
Absolutely. But what is interesting is that we may think that values and norms, because they are invisible or intangible, have no effect. But the effect in societies is that, for instance, today, only 15% presidents across the world are women, 15%. So the social norms are driving our society.
You know, there's one especially disturbing finding in the report. 25% of the world's people believe it is justified for a man to beat his wife. What was the survey question that people were responding to?
That exactly what you are reading.
Really? That was the question. Is it okay to beat your wife?
Yes. It's shocking. It's very shocking. This belief has devastating implications, right? Just to give you an example, 1 in 3 women have experienced either physical or sexual violence in their lives. So it's pretty worrisome.
Where in the world, Raquel, is progress being made when it comes to places that are coming around to erasing these biases? Like, what countries would you point to and what are they doing?
Well, we know very well, right, the Nordic countries. Iceland is scoring at the top of gender equality indexes. Sweden, even though now there is somehow a change towards a more conservative government. Nordics, but there are also phenomenal examples in the south. And those are the countries where they invest in education, they invest in universal social protection, where they invest in a strong institutionality to promote gender equality institutions. And we have good examples, some good examples, absolutely, yes. Even though we also see a big backlash.
And who is responsible for that backlash and what are they saying?
Well, it's very difficult to find a responsible because it's always a combination of factors. But we are very aware that there are anti-gender movements, global movements, well-organized, orchestrating this kind of push against women's rights and the rights of other people like LGBTQI, like immigrants. So there are some anti-democratic projects around that we need to pay a lot of attention to.
Well, we know feminism often gets painted with the woke brush in the United States. How does that play out in other countries?
Well, there is a global trend, as I said, right? So these kind of conservative movements have identified a very clear agenda against women's reproductive rights, against sexual education, against immigration. So it's a global agenda.
Raquel Lagunas is head of gender equality for the United Nations Development Program. She was briefing us on a new report from the UN that quantifies the persistent bias against women worldwide. Raquel, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you.
We're right back with you in just a moment. You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. In Mexico, a disturbing discovery has made the news. It is a reminder of the fate of tens of thousands of disappeared people in Mexico. The World's TV Isaiah reports.
The story unfolded in the state of Jalisco in western Mexico. Late last month, several families reported that their relatives never came home from work. Six men and two women, all in their 20s and 30s, were reported missing. Then the police got an anonymous tip telling them to look at the bottom of a ravine in the area. They did, and what they found was disturbing. Dozens of trash bags had been dumped there, and they all contained human remains.
Algunos de los hallazgos o de los indicios coinciden con algunas de las
víctimas. Jalisco's Attorney General Luis Joaquín Méndez said these were indeed the bodies of the missing call center workers. But this wasn't a normal call center. Investigators discovered that the employees were scamming people over the phone and that the call center was run by one of Mexico's most violent gangs, the Jalisco New Generation Cartel.
They've really become multi-commodity entrepreneurs.
Falco Ernst is a security expert with the International Crisis Group. He says cartels have diversified their activities beyond the traditional business of drug trafficking.
So it's not really surprising that they would branch out into call centers and, more classical fraud and phone-based extortion schemes.
Earlier this year, the U.S. sanctioned several Mexican companies in Jalisco that were scamming Americans through fake offers to buy their timeshares. They were also working on behalf of the Jalisco New Generation Cartel. Ernst says many young people in Mexico are vulnerable to these kinds of schemes.
Imagine that you're young, you don't have a lot of job and employment opportunities on the ground, and then all of a sudden, a buddy of yours tells you, like, hey, there's this job, it doesn't pay that bad, basically, and you can make some money right away. Of course, you're going to be interested, and you might just notice what you're actually supposed to do once you're in.
And once you're in, you are in. Getting out of a criminal organization usually means violent consequences, according to Parker Asman. He's with Inside Crime, a think tank that follows organized crime in the Americas.
Oftentimes, there are only two ways to leave an organized crime group in Mexico, either death or going to prison. So when an individual tries to leave the group, extreme violence is not uncommon to try and keep them in the organization or to dissuade others from leaving.
He says the call center workers might have tried to leave their jobs before they were killed. Call centers are a major source of employment in Mexico for migrants who may have learned English in the United States and then returned to Mexico. Activist Hector Flores, whose son disappeared 2 years ago in a different case, said in an interview with a local TV station that call center workers have been going missing in Mexico for years.
Yo pienso que falta voluntad primero que nada.
Flores says there is a lack of political will to investigate cases of missing persons. Just last year, about 14,000 people disappeared in Mexico.
Hay víctimas, tenemos compañeros en el colectivo que desgraciadamente encuentran a sus familiares en fosas.
There are members of our organization that have found missing relatives in mass graves, Flores says. But when they go to the authorities, the police will often say, consider yourself lucky, because most people never do find their loved ones. According to a study from last December, around 90% of homicides in Mexico go unsolved. For The World, I'm Tibisa Isaiah.
Beirut is still recovering from that massive explosion at its port in 2020. The blast killed more than 200 people and destroyed large parts of the Lebanese capital. One place heavily damaged was a beloved museum called Sour Souk. Now, 3 years later, after months of careful restoration, the museum has reopened. The World's Shirin Jafari reports.
From the outside, the beauty of the Sour Souk Museum is striking. Its 20th century architecture reflects both Venetian and Ottoman styles. colorful stained glass windows stand out against the white exterior. Pictures from the aftermath of the explosion in 2020 show shards of stained glass strewn on the ground. Zeina Arida, the museum's director at the time, described the extent of the damage in a video posted to the museum's Twitter page.
The tinted glass, which is a landmark of Sursok Museum, is completely blown away. There is no more glass in the whole building. There is no more door, so all the wooden doors, the fireproof doors, it's all blown away.
In the days following the blast, people were angry at those in charge of the port. They said their negligence led to the death of at least 200 people, including children as young as 2 years old. This was also at the time when Lebanon was dealing with a crushing financial crisis that had sent three quarters of the population into poverty.
There was a sense of helplessness because it was such an apocalypse. There was a big, scare that nothing will be recovered.
Karina El-Helou is the current director of the Sursuk Museum. She says so much needed to be done, it felt overwhelming. Donations in Lebanon were scarce, she says, because of the state of the economy. Thankfully, France, Italy, and the International Alliance for the Protection of Heritage raised around $2 million. El-Helou says that's when the restoration efforts began. Maya Hosseini, a glass artist, was hired to repair the stained glass windows. For decades, Hosseini had worked to restore Beirut's historic glass windows that were destroyed during the country's civil war. She painstakingly put them together one by one, piece by piece. In 2020, 2 decades worth of her work was destroyed in a matter of seconds, she said. It's a very difficult type of art, she told the BBC in 2020. I put so much of my soul into it. She was back to work again, fixing the glass panels like she was solving a puzzle. Karina El-Helou, the museum's director, says while most of the stained glass and the carved wooden panels have been repaired, reminders of the explosion remain.
The work titled Consolation by Paul Geragosian, dated 1970.
Geragosian's parents were survivors of the Armenian genocide and settled in Lebanon in the late 1940s. His painting, called Consolation, features several tall figures standing side by side and looking hunched over. He painted it using his signature thick, sweeping brushstrokes. And when the explosion happened, some of this paint fell off. Restoration experts were not able to repair it. El-Helou says that's okay.
So there's actually one work that holds the memory of this event.
In all, 57 works of art needed to be restored.
People were very much looking forward to see this rebirth.
When the Sursok Museum held the reopening ceremony last month, 4,000 people showed up.
It's a safe space today. In a city where, you know, there has been so much trauma.
A safe space that 2-year-old Isaac Ollers regularly visited with his parents. Isaac was killed at his home by the explosion. Now a swing in the garden of the museum marks his memory. For The World, I'm Shirin Jafari.
We'll be right back. You're listening to The World. The impacts of long COVID can be severe, but there's promising new research that could offer hope for people struggling with it and other afflictions.
We can also start the same kind of trial for people with chronic fatigue syndromes. Often there's just no good treatment at all, and people are suffering for decades.
Plus, calling all birds, the discovery of a really old flute ahead on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. In Ukraine, authorities are investigating tens of thousands of potential war crimes committed by Russia. Some cases have already resulted in convictions in Ukrainian courts, but so far only one type of war crime has brought an arrest warrant from the International Criminal Court, the unlawful deportation of children from occupied areas in Ukraine to Russia. The World's Daniel Hoffman has this report about Ukrainian families trying to bring their kids back home.
In mid-February, Vladimir Putin met with Maria Lvova-Belova. She's the president's so-called Children's Rights Commissioner.
наших граждан по поводу усыновления.
More Russian families have been adopting kids from Ukraine, Putin said. And Львова Белова has been leading these efforts.
Сами ребенка усыновили из Мариуполя, да?
Да. Ну, благодаря вам.
Маленький?
Нет, 15 лет. Теперь я знаю, что такое быть.
In this exchange, Львова Белова says that she personally adopted a child from Mariupol, a city in southern Ukraine occupied by Russian forces, and she thanked Putin for all his support. About a month later, Pyotr Hofmanski, the president of the International Criminal Court, announced two arrest warrants connected with the war in Ukraine.
For Vladimir Putin, president of the Russian Federation, and for Maria Lvova-Belova, commissioner of the Russian President for Children's Rights, for the alleged war crimes of deportation of children from Ukrainian-occupied territories into the Russian Federation.
Deporting children from parts of Ukraine to Russia is illegal under international law. Wayne Jordash, an international criminal lawyer based in Kyiv, says that's exactly what's been happening.
Children are taken from orphanages and from occupied territory. And in certain instances, those children are also adopted into Russian families.
Russian authorities claim that they're doing this for the welfare of children, removing kids from war zones and sending them to the safety of Russia. Jordash says this is not a credible explanation.
Why haven't they been in touch with the Ukrainian government immediately to find a safe place for those children to be returned to? Why would you place those children into Russian families? There's many things the Russian administration could do to find their families, reunite them, and it's done barely nothing.
Jordash says it's hard to say exactly how many Ukrainian children have been deported to Russia, but the Ukrainian government says it's documented at least 19,000 cases.
Imagine putting up children for adoption without doing everything you can to find their parents. It's as simple as that. So this is about extinguishing Ukrainian identity. If you can condition Ukrainian children to believe that they are part of Russia, then you won't need to use such brutal force in the future to subjugate Ukraine.
Some Ukrainian parents with missing children feel like they have no choice, so they're taking matters into their own hands. A non-profit organization called Save Ukraine is organizing rescue missions to help Ukrainian parents get their children back. At this event in Kyiv, about a dozen parents and guardians, all of them women, gather before traveling to Russia and occupied Ukrainian territory. Микола Кулеба is the founder and CEO of Save Ukraine.
По-перше, зберігати спокій максимально. Це дуже стресова поїздка.
Кулеба tells the parents that this will be a stressful journey, both physically and psychologically. He warns them that they will likely be questioned by Russian security services.
Ні, я вже просто боюся.
Ви боїтеся, налякали вас.
One parent says she's scared. Some of the other parents nod in agreement.
Все нормально. Все буде прекрасно. Ми віримо в це.
Everything is okay, he says. We're waiting for your return and for your kids to return with you. He then says that their children will be provided with psychological support and everything they need to readjust to life back in Ukraine.
У мене є одне прохання. Мій син дуже любить бокс, виходить, і він би хотів зустрітися з Олександром Мусіком.
З Кличком.
One mother named Tatiana says that she has a request. She says that her son Vlad loves boxing, and when he returns home, he would like to meet a professional boxer. Кулеба says yes, he can make that happen.
Только по видеосвязи, а вживую, ну, ні обнять, ні поцілувати ніяк.
Tatiana tells me about her son Vlad. He's 17 years old, and she's been in touch with him on video chats every day. Tatiana is from Kherson, and she says her son is in Russian custody somewhere in occupied Ukrainian territory. But she doesn't want to give too many details because she's afraid the Russians will mistreat him if they find out that she's speaking to the news media. The women pile into the van. Кулеба is there helping them load their bags into the trunk. He says, God bless you, and they're off.
We are really afraid about this group of mothers, and we are waiting for them, praying for them, and we believe that we will be able to return all children who were abducted before.
This is the seventh trip organized by Kuleba's group. He says they're quite risky because they're not officially authorized by Russian authorities. And when the Ukrainians arrive in Russia, the parents face questioning by the FSB, Russia's state security agency.
It could be hours of interrogation. One of our group have been interrogating almost 14 hours.
Surprisingly, these trips often work. They've helped bring more than 350 kids back to their families in Ukraine.
To rescue just one child, it's whole the world. It's rescue Ukraine. That's why we called Save Ukraine Fund, because saving one child is saving our country.
A few weeks after this particular trip by Ukrainian parents, Kuleba's group announced that 20 children were brought back home. Tatiana's son Vlad was one of them. And he later got to meet Volodymyr Klitschko, a legendary Ukrainian boxer. For the World, Daniel Hoffman, Kyiv, Ukraine.
A transformational, controversial, and larger-than-life Italian politician died today. Silvio Berlusconi was 86. He had once been a crooner on cruise ships, but Berlusconi rose to become a billionaire media mogul and then Italy's longest-serving prime minister. As prime minister, he was happy to return to his one-time job on cruise ships. Berlusconi took entertainment into politics as a populist leader, and for that he was both beloved and reviled for his polarizing rhetoric and outlandish behavior. Leila Simona Talani has followed all of this. She directs the Center for Italian Politics at King's College London. With years of politics that really were defined by Berlusconi, is there one Berlusconi moment that for you captures who he was and his impact on Italy in the last 25 years?
Well, if I have to say, the most striking moment was when he actually entered into politics in Italy. That was in 1994. He had no previous experience in political life. He had just established a party, Forza Italia, like 4 months before.
So I worked as a journalist in Rome in 1995 and covered Berlusconi's first term as prime minister. And the impression I had was someone who just swooped in with this flamboyant embrace of power, which both baffled Italians. It angered, of course, those on the left. But for those in the middle and on the right, it seemed there was a happy acceptance. Am I wrong about that?
No, that was true. It's totally true. As surprising as it may seem, he actually won the election. So he was really accepted. But that, for someone who had never heard of him, was really striking, to be honest. I never thought that could be possible. And the other surprise is that he actually managed to remain in power until today.
So we have to talk about the controversies. For one, Berlusconi was dogged by allegations of corruption over the past 30 years. He fought over 30 court cases, only one ever stuck. Remind us how legal troubles eventually caught up with him and how he got off all the other times.
In Italy, the judicial system is a little bit, let's say, slow, and there are many occasions in which he actually managed to escape convictions because the terms of the trials expired after a certain number of years. So in reality, it's not that he was not found guilty, it's that the trial expired. So that's typical of Italy. There is one case in which he was found guilty for tax fraud in 2012. And then he managed even to get out of these positively because he was portrayed as a victim of the judiciary in Italy. So he was able to escape all of these, which is also the other surprising characteristic of Berlusconi. And also the trials for his sex conduct ended up in acquittals like recently.
Well, we should address his record with women. Berlusconi was known for sexist remarks, those lavish sex parties known as bunga bunga parties. Did any of that hurt him politically?
I don't know. I mean, he should have, but there is also, it must be said, that he resonated with some part of the Italian culture, which is not well known to be particularly pro-females, in a way like Trump, no? Something like this. And might even got him more votes instead of less, not only amongst men, but also amongst women. So he was amazing because he managed to understand Italians profoundly and also to give Italians what they actually wanted, especially men.
Macho culture, as you say.
Yeah, macho culture, yeah.
Berlusconi led his Forza Italia party in a coalition with other right-wingers that ultimately ushered in Giorgia Meloni as prime minister. Do you find it ironic that a woman, Giorgia Meloni, is now the prime minister, the kind of product of Berlusconi's own political story?
It's interesting, I have to say. I mean, at a certain point, we had to have sooner or later a female prime minister. She's for a very traditional role of a woman and the family. And for this reason, it's easier to accept her as a prime minister. She was a minister in one of Berlusconi's governments. She is a creature of Berlusconi by all means. Berlusconi himself had problems accepting the fact that she was prime minister at the beginning of her mandate.
The Kremlin, interestingly, said Putin paid tribute to Berlusconi today, calling him a dear person, a true friend. What kind of relationship did Berlusconi have with Putin?
They were, by all means, friends. I think Berlusconi admired Putin and Putin admired Berlusconi. Then, with the war in Ukraine, Berlusconi just said that he was disappointed, but they sometimes even came with ideas that Putin was, like, misled into war by some people that did not advise him correctly. So he tried to justify Putin in a number of occasions.
I mean, I'm just wondering, based on all of what you just said, what do you think is going to be his lasting legacy? I mean, he does seem like a fixture of the 1990s. What about the future?
For Italy, as I said, the legacy is very controversial. The fact that he changed the Italian political system, not necessarily for the better. So it's true, before him, the Italian political system was something. After him, became something completely different. In a way, more modern way of politics, to populism. So he definitely changed the Italian political system, there is no doubt. There is a pre-Berlusconi and a post-Berlusconi. In terms of like having a legacy, like a positive legacy, that is, you know, to be discussed.
Leila Simona Talani is director of the Center for Italian Politics at King's College London. Thank you very much for your time today.
Thank you.
In Colombia, four children were rescued this weekend after being lost in the Amazon rainforest for 40 days. The siblings went missing on May 1st when the airplane they were on crashed into a remote patch of jungle. The three adults on board, including their mother, died in the accident. But the children, ages 1, 4, 9, and 13, they all survived. They are now in a hospital in Bogota, where they've been shielded from the press. Army doctor Carlos Rincon says that they're in decent shape. The children are malnourished and they suffered from mosquito bites, he says. Meanwhile, Colombia is celebrating while they and the rest of the world are wondering how the kids were able to survive alone in the jungle for so long. Reporter Manuel Reda is following the story in Bogota.
The survival story of these four indigenous children has gripped Colombia for the past month. On May 16th, the military found a small plane deep in the rainforest. The bodies of the adults were quickly recovered, but the four children were nowhere to be found. Sensing that they might be alive, the military stepped up its search and flew 150 troops into the remote area around the crash site, recording this footage along the way. It rains there almost every day, and the foliage is so thick that it limits visibility to a 60-foot radius. Dozens of volunteers from Colombia's indigenous tribes also joined the search. They were led by indigenous leader Luis Acosta. We combined both forces, he says, the army's strategic knowledge with the spiritual and cultural knowledge of indigenous people. During the search, the indigenous volunteers conducted traditional ceremonies, and the military combed the jungle with dogs and GPS devices. Meanwhile, helicopters flew over the area, blasting a message recorded by the children's grandmother. It told them to stay in one place so that they could be found. On Friday, the children were finally reached by one of the groups of indigenous volunteers in a small forest clearing. They looked dehydrated and thin, and one of them, 4-year-old Tien, could hardly stand up. A video taken by the rescue party shows a volunteer holding the smallest child, a 1-year-old, and singing a lullaby in an indigenous language. Now, as the children recover, there are still many unanswered questions about how they were able to survive for so long in such a difficult place. At a small bakery outside the hospital, I speak with their grandfather, Narciso Mukutui. He says the children are from the Winani tribe.
A los niños desde pequeño le enseñamos del árboles, de bejuco, de frutas.
From a young age, we teach them about the rainforest, he says, of the fruits, the insects, the animals there. Mukutui has been visiting his grandchildren at the hospital and has spoken several times to Leslie, who is 13 and is the oldest child in the group. She told them that there was food in the plane when it crashed.
Mi nieta me contó cuando el avioneta cayó, mi primo Herman Mendoza traía como 3 kilos de farina.
There were 3 kilos of cassava flour on board, Bukutui says. He adds that the children stayed at the crash site for 4 days. Then, according to Bukutui, the children wandered away, trying to find a way out of the jungle.
Ella me cuenta que comían tubérculos que ella arrancaba. Entonces encontraron copo azul.
My granddaughter says they ate roots that she pulled out of the ground and fruits from trees like copo azul. They slept on the ground after making shelters with leaves, he says. Mukutui says the children heard rescue teams trying to find them. But they hid away, like they were used to doing when their parents would fight. After days of wandering in the rainforest, the children were so weak they gave up on hiding. And that's when they were found.
No, pues para mí es una alegría. Ves que uno tiene esa, como decir.
We're very happy to see them, Mukutui says. And so pleased that people who don't know us have been rooting for us. The children's father, Manuel Ranoque, had a different account of their time in the rainforest. He spoke to reporters outside the hospital.
Ella lo único que me aclara es que la mamá estuvo 4 días viva.
Leslie told me that their mother was alive for the first 4 days after the crash, he says. As she died, she told them to go and look for help. The children are expected to be in the hospital for the next 3 weeks. As the days pass, more details of their extraordinary ordeal are likely to emerge. For The World, I'm Manuel Rueda, in Bogotá.
People struggling with long COVID say they often feel alone and unseen, while the rest of the globe behaves as if COVID is totally a thing of the past. Now research is uncovering just how devastating long COVID can be. A new British study found that long COVID can leave individuals with worse fatigue and quality of life than stage 4 lung cancer. Findings like those are adding urgency to efforts to track down treatments for the debilitating condition. Yale professor and immunologist Akiko Iwasaki is on the cutting edge of that research. Last week, at a ceremony in Frankfurt, she received a $2.5 million prize for her work on phenomena like long COVID. I began by asking her what her plans are for the prize money.
We are planning to use this prize money to further our research on long COVID, as well as other related diseases. Because, you know, if we can find a medical treatment that effectively treats a subset of long COVID, we can also start the same kind of trial for people with chronic fatigue syndromes, which are often there's just no good treatment at all. And people are suffering for decades with this disease. So that is precisely our hope, is to find the overlap between these diseases.
Right. There's an estimated 65 million people around the globe who are living with some type of long COVID. And that's a really loose estimate because at this point, the scientific community, as you know, does not have a shared definition of what long COVID is, does it?
That's right. That's just an estimate of, say, 10% of the people who got infected with COVID developing this condition. But there isn't a single uniform definition that people are using around the world to define long COVID. So yeah, it's likely an underestimate.
Professor, do you have a definition of your own for long COVID?
That's a very tricky subject. So, you know, the CDC definition is at least 4 weeks of symptoms, but we are extending that a little bit longer to include people who are 6 to 12 weeks out with symptoms. And the reason for us doing that in our own studies is to capture the people who are going to have long-term symptoms as opposed to people who spontaneously recover in the 4 or 5 weeks post-infection.
Do you think we're getting any closer to understanding the cause of long COVID?
Yeah, so that's what we're investigating, is what are the causes of long COVID? First of all, long COVID is likely multiple different diseases that are classified under one umbrella. And we are pursuing 4 different hypotheses, one of which is persistent virus infection, and another one being autoimmune diseases that's triggered by an acute infection. The others being latent viruses like herpes virus family members reactivating and causing disease. And finally, tissue level changes that occur as a result of infection that chronically changes the property of different organs, including the brain. So these are 4 different things that we're pursuing, and they're not mutually exclusive.
Right. So probing all those possibilities and the possibility that they might overlap, are certain people more at risk for long COVID, or is there a randomness to it that researchers don't yet understand?
We are seeing more patterns. For instance, women of age groups 30 to 50 years of age tend to be dominating the risk for long COVID. While children and older folks can also get long COVID, that seems to be the dominant population. And also, there may be other sort of genetic and environmental factors that contribute to the risk, which we are currently investigating.
There's a kind of sense that long COVID is something that happens mainly to people with underlying conditions or people who are unvaccinated. Is that an accurate perception?
No, it's not an accurate perception. Having had vaccines prior to infection with COVID can reduce the risk for long COVID to some extent, but it's not a 100% protection against long COVID. And also, people without any underlying pre-existing medical conditions can develop long COVID. In fact, I've seen a lot of people who are athletes and extremely fit and had no prior history of medical issues do develop long COVID.
What about efforts to find treatments for the long haulers, the people with long COVID? Are we getting any closer to agreeing on reliable treatments?
We're not close in agreement. Long COVID is a blanket term to describe multiple diseases. So first, we need to understand what are the different types of long COVID and what are the drivers of such long COVID types. Then we can better understand what kinds of therapies might benefit these people. For instance, if persistent virus is what's causing long COVID, we can start treating people with antivirals like Paxlovid, which is a trial that we're starting here at Yale. Whereas if it is autoimmune mediated, antivirals will not have much of an impact.
As I mentioned earlier, Professor, you are a leader in this research. And if I can just switch gears for a moment, I'd like to ask you a bit about what inspired you in your career path and how you got to where you are. I gather your mother was a big inspiration for you?
Absolutely. So I grew up in a household where my mother was an advocate for women in workforce. It's very difficult for women to keep their job after she becomes pregnant and give birth.
Are we talking about in Japan? Yeah.
In Japan, yes, exactly. So she fought for the rights of women to maintain positions in different companies throughout this process, and she was able to fight for other women who came after her. And I've seen her struggle and her colleagues, and this has really given me a sense of justice and fighting for other women. And it's the same thing in science. I mean, you know, women are underrepresented, and science and academia can do a lot better job of fostering women or underrepresented minorities.
Yale professor and immunologist Akiko Iwasaki, last week she received the 2023 Elsa Corona Fresenius Prize for medical research. Professor, thank you very much for your time. And again, congratulations on this honor.
Thank you so much, Marco.
We close today with the sound of a flute that is more than 12,000 years old. The flute itself is not more than 3 inches long and was fashioned out of a prehistoric bird bone. A number of these bones with finger holes were discovered several years ago in northern Israel, but were only recently identified as some kind of musical instrument. Experts suspect the flutes were designed to attract birds, but there's also a sense that holes might have been bored into the tiny bones precisely to make music. Whatever the purpose, we are once again presented with the innate connection between bird songs and humans making music. As Russian composer Sergei Prokofiev, with the help of none other than narrator David Bowie here, reminded us in Peter and the Wolf.
On a branch of a big tree sat a little bird, Peter's friend. "All is quiet, all is quiet," chirped the bird gaily.
That is The World on this Monday. We come to you every weekday from the Nan and Bill Harris Studio and the Department of Communication at UC San Diego, online at theworld.org. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you again tomorrow.
Yes, all is quiet.
From PRX.